There is a chat function in Zoom, so feel free to pop questions in chat, and we will definitely have some time at the end of the presentation for questions. Everybody in the session. So I just wanted to start off and hello everyone and thank you for joining today, taking the time on your Friday, whether you're in BC or Alberta. And before we begin, we would like to acknowledge the land that we're gathered on today is the traditional unceded territories of many nations across BC and Alberta. My name is Lisa Schmidt and I'm the VP here at Habitat. And we have members from our offices online from Kelowna and Calgary, Edmonton, Victoria, and Vancouver. Again, if you have any questions for those who may have just joined, please feel free to use the chat in Zoom and we'll answer those questions as we go. There's also going to be time right at the end of the presentation to ask questions and interact with Patrick and others. And so on that note, I am very pleased to welcome Patrick Walters, the CEO of Whitcraft Boardwalks today. Whitcraft Boardwalks allows for inclusive, accessible pathways through sensitive park and city landscapes. Whitcraft has worked on boardwalk systems across North America. And Patrick, we really appreciate your time and being here with us today. And with that, I'll hand it over to you.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. I'm going to do my best to operate Zoom. I'm not the handiest on this system, so you might have to bear with me a little bit. Let me know that you should be seeing a full screen of Whitcraft Boardwalks and a Boardwalk, correct?
Correct. We've got you, Patrick.
Okay. Awesome. I'm going to go through this in kind of three phases. One is just kind of an intro. We're gonna watch a short case study that we did for the National Park Service here in the United States. And then we're going to get into some of the considerations for just accessible trail design in general. And then we're going to step into the world of boardwalks a little bit. And then I'm going to open it up to questions. I will say that I am better at answering questions than I am at presenting. So please have your questions ready. We can roll through the presentation. So as Lisa said, my name is Patrick Walters. I'm the CEO of Whitcraft. I am not an accessibility expert. I am not an academic. I'm not a researcher. I'm really not an expert in anything other than boardwalks themselves. But I am a businessman that started with Whitcraft 13 years ago and then quickly realized that boardwalks were bigger than the product itself. So it was about the inclusive community. And I got to give credit to two people for that. One is Klaus Heinrich from Gosling Zubeck Engineering. And another one is Bob Krudemacher from the National Park Service. And we'll touch on some of their impact. So I'm going to try to share the video at this stage. So let's see here.
Long live the journey to the depths, the pinnacles, the fringes, the vistas. Yet 80% of this treasure that is the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore remains inaccessible. Yes, a noble start to make it accessible. A viewing platform, a sand carpet, ADA compliant island campsites, wider and safer boardwalks. Eventually, though, the trails narrow and fade. The boardwalks end. Access points get complicated. Safety can be compromised. Limited funding or no funding means feasibility studies and improvements stall. Options are depleted, so the journey itself ceases. Ready? 1 in 5 people will face mobility issues in the near future. By 2020, 1/4 of the world's population, which equals 1.5 billion people, will fall into the 65 and over population, and accessibility becomes an issue impacting every traveler's life eventually.
It's not just because of a federal mandate that we do this. We're all going to be at that place at some point. We don't really see this as not happening. It's just how fast it happens.
The parks are a national treasure. If they're a national treasure, you want them to be able to be enjoyed by as many people as possible.
And Dan does savor what he can access. At some point, though, his walking sticks will get stuck. The way grows too hazardous, so lighthouses, sweeping panoramas will be left for others to savor.
Even an able-bodied person would have a rough time on that trail because it's nothing but a mud pit. So even just improving that, it would be a lot better.
Improvements equal accessibility, meaning Dan and so many others could connect to the heart of the woods and its spiritual and medicinal rawness.
Just waking up and knowing that you're in the woods and you're more or less by yourself and hearing the sounds of the morning or sounds of the evening. Those are really things that are priceless.
Making what is currently inaccessible accessible is an opportunity to be part of a cultural shift where innovation, action, and advocacy could spur real and ongoing progress.
As constituents and citizens and supporters of the national park system, I invite everybody to participate in helping us make this happen.
Long live the journey for us all.
So like I said, that was a case study that we did for the National Park Service. And we did it because of Bob Grunecker that I mentioned earlier. But let's jump into a little bit of history of where we come from in this whole system. Whitcraft Boardwalks was founded in 1954, and back then we were a lakefront dock and pier business. But long in the early 90s, we started getting requests from a lot of municipalities and parks for our dock and pier system. And we knew they didn't have lakefront property, so we started to question them. And we found out that they were using our dock and piers to satisfy the Americans with Disabilities Act, the regulations to increase access within their park. So at that point we launched the Everlevel Quickset boardwalk system that we now have today. So today we only focus on boardwalks for parks and urban environments. Klaus Heinrich was the one that told me that we must build environments that we all can live in. And I kind of shrugged it off when I first heard it. But then as I started going down this path with Whitcraft, it started to make sense. And the fact that we have protected these environments, we've created these spaces, but yet we limit their access by their very structure. So then with Bob's help, these are two of my big mentors in this area. With Bob's help, the thought that Bob came to the table with is that we are all temporarily able-bodied individuals. And I don't know if that's original to Bob, but that's where I heard it. So that's who I give credit to. But what Bob was really referring to was the fact that as an individual, we go through cycles. And as a 61-year-old individual, I don't consider myself mobility challenged at all. But if I compare myself to my 20-year-old and to my 40-year-old, and in the future, my 80-year-old self, there are differences. So what Bob really allowed me to see was that, you know, accessibility is not only wheelchair accessibility. And that was my background.
Yeah, it was actually on time.
Accessibility doesn't necessarily have to be
in that my water sounds.
We all enjoy a certain level of challenge or accomplishment in the environments that we are in. I mean, people don't climb a mountain because it's easy. They climb a mountain for the experience, for the emotional joy of doing that. So, again, making something accessible doesn't necessarily mean paving it all the way to the end so that it's easy to be. The other thing that Bob pointed out was, you know, really the connection between the physical and the emotional experience, the physical place and the emotional experience, and how do those two interact with one another for an individual in an environment. And then the last thing that we spent quite a bit of time with, and I'll touch on a little bit later, is really the cost of exclusion and the cost of inclusion. So currently or today, up to this point, we've all looked at the cost of inclusion. What is it gonna cost to create these environments? Because it is a change. But when you look at the cost of exclusion, the cost of not doing that, the impact is significant. And so you got to ask yourself, you know, why should we care? Why do this? And it's more than just because it just feels good or it's the right thing to do. But it is because it's good for business. And really, when I say that, as a business owner, but also as somebody that has looked back on how the park systems themselves were created and continue to be protected. And it's because of the fact that we started to realize the economic value and impact these protected spaces have or these enjoyed shared environments have. So, and then if you look at the fact of the matter is that, you know, 1 in 5 adults live with mobility challenges. And those are only the ones that are going to raise their hand and say, yes, I have a mobility challenge. But it's not, it doesn't take into the account of people that have, you know, inner ear or dizziness issues or balance issues or sight issues that may be not something that they themselves consider a mobility challenge, but in effect does very much challenge their ability to get around. So why care? Because why would you limit yourself? Why would you limit 20% of your potential visitors right out of the gate? So 1 in 5 adults have mobility challenges. If you eliminate the one, you've just eliminated 20% of your potential market. The other thing that's critical to understand is that, you know, an individual with mobility challenges does not often travel by themselves. On average, they travel with 2 additional individuals. So not only are you limiting that one individual, but you're limiting their party as well. So, and if you look at that, the economic impact of a traveler with mobility challenges is 3 to 5 times greater than the economic impact of a single traveler. So for all those places that cater to the single traveler, that's great. That's wonderful. But if you're traveling, but if you're catering or at least providing services for individuals with mobility challenges, your impact for every one of those is going to be 3 to 5 times greater than the single traveler. So the other thing is that planners with mobility challenges in their party, so somebody that is actually planning the vacation, that has a child or a spouse with mobility challenges, do a significantly more research in where they're going to go. So they're not likely to just show up at a park to see what is there. They're going to do some research on that park. They're going to know exactly what services, what abilities are there for them to do. So, and then the last thing to think about is that, you know, if you create unique facilities in your environment, a boardwalk platform, an observation area being some of them, they get photographed. And those experiences get shared and get shared widely. So it does a lot of the marketing for you in your environment. So where do we start with all of that as kind of a backdrop is, okay, so we got an idea that we should do it. There's some economic value to doing it. You know, where do we start? We actually start with some of the really small things. And there are some really small things that make a big difference. And for this part of the presentation, I'm just going to go through some kind of a slideshow of some examples, cases that we've worked on. You know, this one here is an observation platform at the top of a very large sand dune in Michigan. But what's interesting to note is that this surface transition right here, if you can see where the cursor is, they did these gravel boxes for individuals specifically with sight impairment, so that they know when they're going from one environment to another, and yet they try to keep one element consistent across that being the curb rail here, so that they know that they're going from one environment to another. They're going from the trail to something else. They're going to the trail to the boardwalk. Here's another example of the same thing. I would have liked to have seen them extend the handrail out a little bit further on this one. But the same concept holds true here. They're going from a trail that is very controlled, it is very guided, to something that's a little bit less guided, to something that's even less guided. What you don't see here is the next turn is, if you keep walking down this trail, the next turn is actually a gravel path, but that gravel path is actually lined with small rocks, small stones, to give them an indication that the trail is turning. So focus on little things like just the surface transitions that they're going through to indicate change. The other thing that has been common is the use of guide ropes. And not only just the use of guide ropes, but the use of items on the guide rope. If you can see the little block there on that piece of rope, that's literally there to give them a signal that they're actually coming to the end of the guide rope, so that they don't, when they get to the next pillar, they understand that the rope that is hanging there is no longer they're available for. But at that point, they're already walking on the same surface. And then, of course, you can see where the guide rope comes in, and then it hits onto the boardwalk, but yet then they go on to a curb rail. So another example of guide ropes where, you know, again, this is not for safety of anything. You know, it's not going to save a small child from falling over, and they're only about a foot off the ground anyways. But it is there for just the guide for an individual, visually impaired individual. To make sure that they're on the path. Looking at things like handrails, you know, this is a very simple adjustment, and this adjustment was actually done post installation. So this boardwalk existed, and then they came back in and lowered those sections for ADA fishing spots. Again, it was an afternoon's worth of work for an individual. But it made such a big difference for the individuals that were trying to fish there that were in a wheelchair. So designs. So again, consider yourself, you know, put yourself in the situation. You know, if an individual, you know, is a small child or an individual in a wheelchair, seeing through a handrail can also be difficult. So this is, again, this is the Paul H. Douglas Center. It's a national park property. They used a stainless steel cable railing so that the kids that were in wheelchairs, it's at an education center. They had several kids in wheelchairs, and they wanted to make sure that their view was unobstructed. So they used a horizontal cable safety railing for their cable, for their handrails. When I said, you know, put yourself in their position, you know, this was an exercise that I found was really helpful, where we literally, the organizers at the Grass River Nature Preserve blocked one of your senses and then had you experience the trail. And it was a 700-foot-long boardwalk, and they had you experience the trail without one of your senses. And then the exercise was to describe both what you saw, what you experienced with that sense and without that sense. What did you miss? And then what was picked up because you didn't have that sense? And then taking that information and putting it onto the boardwalk or onto the path as an experiential exercise or experience for the individuals walking on the trail. So you heard Dan in the video talking a lot about, you know, the emotional experience of the physical place that he was in. And you know, what Dan's experience was is historically when he would go, quote unquote, camping, the camping experience, his experience in the outdoors was literally pulling the motorhome up to a concrete pad, opening the door, going out onto a concrete pad, and living on that concrete pad. And he really missed, and you can imagine if you're in a motorhome on a concrete pad, you're in an environment that has a lot of motorhomes and a lot of concrete pads. And he really wanted that, you know, backcountry wilderness experience. And the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, which was the feature in that case study, is within the national park, the U.S. National Park Service. It is considered the most accessible, inaccessible park in the entire system. And what that means is that you have these series of islands, the Apostle Islands in Lake Superior. And once you arrive on that island, whether that be you know, by kayak or by powerboat, once you arrive there, you are as remote as you could possibly be. You're about 5 miles from the nearest town, nearest civilization. And the experience the emotional experience that individual is having at that point is not about sleeping on cold, wet ground. The emotional experience that person is having for being there is being in the wilderness. So what you're looking at here is accessible campsites that are all raised platforms. And actually the National Park Service invented this very unique little clip thing that fits down in between the boards that you can see are the tent stakes for the tent. But that system goes from the picnic table to a grated fire pit that is on the boardwalk. And yes, it is actually on the boardwalk. You'll see a picture of it later. But that system goes from there, it goes to the privies. It goes to the launch/dock that is about a quarter mile away from where they're staying. And so it really gives them an experience of being in the wilderness. This is another example of that same camping facility. So this is a group a group camp group presentation facility. The top picture is the before, the bottom is the after. But you can see that the top picture is one that, you know, the individual, and again, it's not necessarily the person with in a wheelchair. So this is where it really hit home for me when Bob Krumecker said, you know, if you sit there and watch the fire for a half hour with somebody that has, you know, early glaucoma, and they turn around to leave, they are completely blinded and disoriented to get back to the trail. So, you know, it wasn't just, you know, the individual that you think of. It's all of us. At some point in time, it will be all of us. So they challenged us to create a amphitheater, if you will. So you can see that, you know, we have an amphitheater style. Those benches do move so that they can be rearranged. On the far side of that, there's an ADA ramp that comes down. But it is fully ADA accessible. And it goes all the way back to the trail, to the privies, to the campsites, to the docks, making Sand Island, one island in the Apostle Islands, the most accessible, inaccessible camping experiences in the National Park Service. So, so really, what I want to make sure that everyone kind of walks away with is some considerations. You know, there are some very simple things you can do. You know, and then it kind of grows from there. But I want you to consider the fact that, you know, boardwalks are the most single photograph element in a park. And what I mean by that is that if you know, think about the number of times you've looked at a vacation brochure or at a hotel brochure or at even gone on Google and looked at a location, a park that you're thinking of visiting. If they have a boardwalk, that boardwalk is photographed in those pictures. So, and if they're being photographed, they are most likely being promoted. So also boardwalks are highly accessible methods of providing both that physical and emotional experience for an individual across generations. You know, how many photographs have you seen of the, you know, grandparent and the child, or the couple standing at the end of the boardwalk holding hands, or the child, you know, leaning over the edge looking at the wildlife below. So, also consider that these structures are highly versatile in their application. We've been talking about a boardwalk as a path, but you saw examples of a boardwalk being a tent platform, a observation deck, a gathering spot, a patio style. So they are very versatile in nature. So so consider the fact that, you know, boardwalks are really your best trail alternative in promoting accessibility, but also in things around, you know, protecting sensitive soils and root areas, you know, providing habitat, shelter and comfort, as well as controlling traffic and the visitor's experience. And again, if you can control the traffic and the experience, you're really going to be able to promote and protect those critical areas, because that's one of the challenges is that, you know, typically, you know, we want to get individuals to the most prized area in the park or the environment, but we also want to do it in a respectful and meaningful way, and do it so that it doesn't harm that area as well. So, historically, and this is the sad part of the presentation, and that is that historically, boardwalks are one of the least maintained, and I would argue it's because they are the least maintainable structures. So, you know, the typical lifespan of a traditional field-built post-and timber style boardwalk is about 20 years. It starts to fail after about 5 years. So what I want you to consider is if you are going to do a boardwalk, consider designing it from the ground up. And what I mean by that is make sure you understand the soils that you're sitting on. Do you need to penetrate those soils? Or can you sit and rest right at grade on those soils? The other thing is that when you design from the ground up, make sure that the most long-lasting, durable products that you're using, materials that you're using, are at the lowest level, meaning that you're building a foundation of a house, you don't build it on sand. You make sure that it's concrete or something that is structural in nature. Follow current building means and methods. Historically, again, boardwalks were built by the maintenance or operations people, and God love maintenance and operations people. They put a lot of our boardwalks in. But historically, the operations and maintenance individuals were instructed to go build a boardwalk. So they grabbed some lumber and went out and built a boardwalk with no engineering or life cycle considerations given. So follow those building codes, those standards, the international building code standards for pedestrian loading. Follow the construction means and methods of any structure that is going to be taking individuals across an area. So select materials that are relatable in characteristics. And what I mean by this is that make sure that when you're constructing those boardwalks, that the materials are chosen in a sequence of life cycle. I was at a boardwalk 2 weeks ago, and they had this beautiful 3x8 cedar decking that was just gorgeous, and big 4x4 curb rails for safety. And the individual was excited and was talking about the fact that, this was going to be their standard. But when I looked underneath, that whole deck structure was built on 2x8s, vertical 2x8 framing structures. And what's wrong with that is that 2x8 has about a lifespan of about 10 years usable. It has a load capacity of about 1,000 pounds reliably. And the deck that they had on there had a 35-year lifespan and about a 10,000-pound load limit. So clearly, it was a house built on cards. So select materials that are relatable in characteristics. They should have just done that. They should have just flipped that upside down, built it on top of 3x8s and used 2x8s for the decking. Use metrics in the design and installation and maintenance of your projects. So when you're looking at constructing a boardwalk, make sure that just like any other project that you're doing, you are using a set of metrics that will allow you to measure the success of both the design and the installation and the maintenance. Know how many linear feet per day you're expected to be able to install or build in the field. Know that when it gets designed and built, know that 2% of your annual expense of that boardwalk is going to be on maintenance, if that is the case. So, and then the final thing is that, I'll really kind of stress the idea of keeping the end user's experience
at the forefront.
Too often it's just a matter of getting across that wetlands that is important, and it's not important to understand what the wetlands actually represent and how the user is going to experience that wetlands. So those are the things that I really wanted to try to drive home and say that we should be be considering these things when we're looking at a boardwalk system. Obviously, you know, Whitcraft is in the business of building boardwalks. If you're interested in those boardwalks, I would, you know, recommend reaching out to Habitat and connecting. But these are our experiences, and these are only our experiences, but I want to make sure that they're shared with you. At this point, I'd like to open up, I think I'll open it up to any questions. And like I said, I'm better at questions than I'm at presenting, so, you know, I hope you have some questions for me. Lisa, you're on mute, Lisa.
Yeah, thank you, Patrick, and yep. That was a great presentation, and I think most people are on mute right now, so please feel free to unmute yourselves or use the chat if you're more comfortable to ask questions there. Patrick, maybe I'll yeah. start off just with yeah. a general question. What type of service do you typically see on the projects that you've worked on across North America?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and it really depends on, again, the user's experience. So a lot of times in urban areas where cycling is a very mixed use bike ped oriented boardwalk, we're seeing a lot of fiberglass grating. I think I've heard it referred to as mini mesh in BC. But it's a fiberglass mesh. The traction is real good. The holes are less than 3/8 of an inch, so it's ADA compliant. It is, they call it wheels and heels, which means that it's good for tires and it's good for high heel shoes. But it does have
wheels and heels.
Even when wet, there is a good traction to it. We do a lot. I mean, you know, probably 50% of the boardwalks we do are still with a pressure treated southern yellow, typically southern yellow pine, because it's one of the more structural woods. But a good percentage of that is done using pressure treated. But the disadvantage is it gets slippery when wet. I mean, that's just the nature of wood. We do a lot with HDPE plastic or recycled milk jugs. You know, that has a good, some good traction on it. It's got a 50-year lifespan, so the lifespan is very good. There's literally zero maintenance you can do on an HDPE. And I will point out that there's a big difference between HDPE plastics and what's called composites. So when you talk about a composite material, a composite is literally like a hot dog. There's filler in the inside, then there's a wrapper on the outside. I would strongly recommend staying away from a composite that is not a solid material from edge to edge, surface to surface, because once that veneer, that wrapper gets compromised, then moisture gets in and it starts to delaminate and it becomes a maintenance issue. But the drawback in plastics or composites is that because they have because they're made out of plastic, it's like walking on your carpet in the winter and then touching a doorknob sometimes, because the property of it is static electricity. So you're going to get a little bit more static electricity with that.
Everything has a drawback.
Like I said, fiberglass and bar gratings are great products, but they're very expensive. So it really depends on the type of environment that we're going into. So,
okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Other questions from the group?
I'll ask a question. So you are mentioning sort of traction with the different materials that you're making decks out of, and slippery when wet, yellow.
Yep.
Pine is the majority, I guess, of things that we're putting out there from a collective standpoint. I know that one of the things that people do in my area, because it does rain a lot, so it's would be slippery for the most part. We're in a rainforest on the West Coast. And One of the things that we see a lot of, especially on slopes into marinas, is shingles, asphalt shingles that people adhere to wood, so that there is that kind of grit and traction. But I also have seen kind of like metal, so this might be the thing that you're talking about with the wheels and heels, where like a metal grating that they put on there, so there is like something sort of to grab onto. And I know, too, that in earlier in the week, they were talking about, the static part. So from the recognition that everything has a good thing and a bad thing going for it, every material, what is the sort of, like, your recommendation for something that is can stand the test of time from a wetness perspective? Because we have a really great trail that we have, the Leaner Boardwalk Trail, and it was built many years ago. And we do try to get, like, a power washer out there to brush off the debris. But it's, we see how time has worked on it, and we see how that was a huge investment that we may not be able to kind of maintain forward. Thanks.
So there's a couple of things there, Sarah. So Wickrep starts with a structural steel framing system. That's really where we kind of differentiate ourselves. So we are a structural steel framing system. And then we deck it with whatever decking material is the choice of the environment, whatever the design intent is for the environment. So, you know, like I said, you know, the fiberglass stuff, the aluminum bar grating, we do a lot of that in the urban areas. You know, in more of the primitive rustic areas, we're doing a lot of the pressure treated lumber. Two key things there. One is when I said you have to be mindful of the life cycle of the boardwalk, right? So this galvanized structural steel framing system is going to last 100 years guaranteed. That's just structural steel, right? And it'll never need to be maintained because there's arguably really nothing you can do to it. It's structural steel. But the deck material can range from, you know, like we were talking about, pressure treated southern yellow pine, which is going to be slippery. That's the drawback. The benefit is that in 15 years, when it does deteriorate, you can tear up the deck panels and drop new deck panels in place, and now you have a brand new boardwalk, right? With the discussion of, you know, how do you make a current boardwalk less slippery, I think you were kind of hitting on some of the things. You know, they've done everything from, you know, chicken wire to shingles to, you know, all sorts of things. There is actually a company, and I'm going to turn around and look. It's actually called Get a Grip. And they're actually from British Columbia. And if you walk on boardwalks, you know, especially around Vancouver, you'll notice, I noticed anyways, they look like a small chain screen almost. And they're 2 inches and they're, you know, 24 inches wide. They can be attached to the individual boards, just like the asphalt shingles can be. Mm-hmm. But again, that comes down to who's going to maintain that, mm-hmm. right? Do you have that in your budget? Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, if you do, that's great. That's your operational budget. Or do you want mm-hmm. to take it out of your capital. You know, capital budget mm-hmm. and do something that, you know, isn't going to be main, that, you know, fiberglass has a 50-year lifespan on mm-hmm. it. So literally a boardwalk made with a structural steel framing system and a fiberglass top, yes, it is, the top is going to be 2 times more expensive than the traditional boardwalk. Mm-hmm. Our frame structure is actually less expensive than a wooden structure, but the fiberglass is going to be 2 times expensive, but it's going to last
longer,
significantly longer, and you're not going to need to maintain it. Mm-hmm. So does that answer your question?
Yeah. It really does. And we even have like a dock too, where there's like the under sort of in the water timber part where that is sort of failing from years of just existing, yeah. And then the concrete on top, which is still sort of usable in that sense. So it's sort of the opposite of what you have, where the metal bottom can keep lasting, but then the fiberglass is only half as long, right? Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah, not a problem. Anyone else?
All right. Well, everybody online today, happy Friday. Thanks for joining us. If you have questions, please feel free to reach out to Habitat and we can connect you with Patrick. And Patrick, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you.
What a great way to wrap up National Accessibility Week. So thank you.
Yes. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Have a great day, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Patrick.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Another great accessibility presentation. I think I'm out of this now. We're done. Thanks, Lisa Schmidt. Bye-bye. Leave the meeting. Boo-boo. And cool. So I'm maybe going to read another couple pages from that book I was reading last time. It's Kicking Asperger's One Meltdown at a Time by Jeremy Tolme, Dave Ray, and Joel Mark Harris. I think I stopped on page 12. But I, you know, I'm just thinking about how, I'll just do a little personal chats first. So this is Sarah Fowler. You're listening to the Waterfowl Podcast, which is produced in beautiful British Columbia, Tassis, Nootka Sound, at the Green Antler on Discovery Crescent. And so a couple years back, I went into my back deck, fell through one of the soft woods where it was like receiving a drip from a hole in the eaves trough, and I didn't fall very far. I only went, you know, into the, in with one leg on the soft spot. So we have taken that deck down now. So now it's just sort of a big hole where the deck used to be, where there's like a concrete slash rock, foundation. And we do have a bunch of timber that we're planning to rebuild the deck with eventually when we get some time. But I see how, you know, even on the front steps to the front of the house, there's a wooden deck that is, you know, starting to show some signs of wear. There's a few risers in the steps that are wiggly. The other day when I stepped into the front door, I thought, is this deck farther away from the house than it was before? Just trying to monitor those, like, places that break off. And I have a kiwi plant that is sort of growing up the front of it. And I'm sort of trying to make a living deck where it will be, where if all the wood sort of rots away, at least the kiwi will keep growing and hold whatever is possible, like whatever sawdust together with growth. But thinking about the stainless steel foundation and how that is maybe, like you see in Montreal, a lot of places with spiral stairs coming up the front that are metal, like a kind of fire escape. So maybe that's how this will eventually go. We've been in this house for a couple years, 8 years, and we did, from an asset management perspective, switch from roof, asphalt roofing to metal roofing because of the fact that it will last longer. So it rains a lot here, like I said, and we had some leaks, and so now we have metal roofing, which I think that the replacement sort of timeline on that is the screws give way or the washers on the screws give way at maybe 20 or 30 years. So instead of putting a whole new asphalt roof on, we need to go around and change out the screws. But I don't actually know for sure. That's just what I understand to be true, which could not be true. I am always learning. So, like I said, freeze and press. This is Jeremy Tolme, and he's talking about, I started getting bullied in grade 4. This contributed a lot to my difficulties in school and with people in general. Most of the time I felt petrified the moment I left the house. My days were filled with anxiety until I came home again. I think I read this part last time. I suffered in silence for the longest time, too scared to say anything or do anything. My usual protective mechanism of crying, which had up to this point been effectively deployed with my parents, didn't work with these kids. I generally tried to be as quiet as possible, hoping nobody would notice me or care. Of course, this only made the bullying worse. One time, I was playing outside with the neighborhood kids. The house next door was in the process of being built, and the kids started started to climb the rafters. I didn't want to be left alone, so I started to climb with them. I pulled my body up onto the beams, but couldn't find a way to climb back down. I called out to the other kids to help me, but they just laughed and ran away. There I was, terrified, up on this wooden beam, high above the ground. I didn't know what to do and had visions of staying up there until it got dark. Thankfully, my mother, who had been keeping a close eye on us, came to investigate. She found me and helped me climb back down. Midway through grade 6, the bullying was so bad, I eventually told my parents. They went to the school, to the bully's parents, and to the police. We even tried to get a restraining order against one of the particularly bad bullies, but strangely enough, the bully said I was bullying him. This was completely ridiculous. One look at my skinny arms and tiny body, and anyone could tell that I couldn't bully anyone. I was afraid, I was angry and upset, and of course, the restraining order went nowhere, and the bullying only got worse. One time, the boy tripped me. I got so mad, I wanted to retaliate. Knowing I couldn't try a direct assault, I had to find a weak spot. My brother was standing next to him. I held up my backpack ready as a weapon, but the bully tripped me again before I could get to his younger brother. Epic failure. I went home once again defeated. I had this one friend who flat out told me that he couldn't be friends with me at school because I wasn't popular enough. Although if I wanted, we could hang out at home. I was okay with that because I took what I could get, but my mother was incensed. She told me that she wouldn't have this boy over unless he was friends with me at school as well. For a few summers, my parents put me into camp on Newcastle Island and once on Salt Spring Island. I hated camps because I didn't get along with other kids and we played a lot of sports and other outdoor activities and I wasn't particularly good at. The camp only made me feel like more of an outsider than I already felt. All the other kids had friends and made friends easily, not me. I was shy and quiet and would count the days until I got to go home and sleep in my own bed. When I was 14, I did a training program on Salt Spring to become a camp leader, and then the next year I did training in Nanaimo. I eventually abandoned my training when I realized that to be a good camp leader, I would have to become a good people person. Of course, not everything was doom and gloom during my early years. I have wonderful memories of some amazing birthdays. My birthday is December 27th, so my parents always went out of their way to make me feel special and not just skip over it because it was so close to Christmas. One birthday, my parents hired a clown to make animal balloons, and they made a videotape, which is now on YouTube. On my 9th birthday, we started a tradition that continues to this day. My parents and I go for pizza and a movie. Other times we took road trips to see the Seattle Mariners ball games, traveled to Disney World, and even visited Mexico. During one trip to Seattle, we were sitting in front of the Space Needle enjoying a beautiful day at the park. I was sitting with my dad while my mom was sitting at the table opposite us. For some reason, I became fascinated with the umbrella and began to fiddle with the lever. My dad kept telling me to stop playing with it, but of course, I didn't listen to him. I rotated the lever a little further, and before I knew it, the umbrella had snapped closed, trapping us inside. I thought my mother would come to rescue us, but she was too busy laughing. Thankfully, a police officer came over and lifted the umbrella to allow for our escape. He didn't think it was very funny, however. Stop goofing around, he told us before walking away. This only made my mother laugh harder. A fond memory I have of Mexico is when the locals got a huge kick out of my red hair. This was the first taste of celebrity status. For my 11th birthday, we went tobogganing at a resort called Vancouver Island called Mount Washington. I couldn't ski worth a damn, but had fun going downhill on the toboggan. My parents thought this was funny and said they wished they had a video camera. I started kickboxing at age 8 as a way to protect myself and gain some confidence. I went for 4.5 years and really enjoyed it. While it didn't really protect me from the bullies, it did give me some confidence. I kickboxed until I was 12 when we moved to Gabriel Island, where there wasn't a facility for me to continue my training. My parents also encouraged me to play sports, which I didn't particularly enjoy. My lack of hand-eye coordination made it a challenge, to say the least. My parents put me in hockey when I was 10 years old. I played with kids 4 years younger than I was because I wasn't good enough to play with kids my own age. I managed to last an entire season, which I thought was pretty good. Playing hockey didn't stick, but my lifelong love of the Vancouver Canucks did. I started to collect the players' jerseys and managed to acquire a substantial collection, including Trevor Linden's Game 6 of the Stanley Cup Finals in 1994. My father would sometimes get box seats to the Vancouver Canucks through work, and we would make the ferry trip across to Vancouver to watch the Canucks play. We would stay the night and make a whole day of it. That was a real treat. Although I hated the crowds and all the people, thankfully, when I was watching the game, I could block it all out, but getting in and out of the stadium was a real problem. I suffered in silence because I didn't want to disappoint my parents. I started to make up stories about playing soccer at lunchtime just to make my mom and dad happy. My stories were elaborate tales of how I would assist in a goal, make a great play, or help win the game. I became very good at lying, although my intention was never to hurt anyone. I just wanted to make my parents proud of me. Eventually, I confessed to them that I wasn't actually playing soccer during lunchtime and had made the whole thing up. My mother stayed home with me until grade 7 when she decided it was a good time to go back to work. In the back of my mind, I still had this nagging suspicion that my parents would somehow disown me or stop caring about me. Of course, my parents were the most loving people a kid could ask for, but I was still scared that I would end up alone. I became resentful and tried to make my parents' lives a living hell to convince them that I could live without them, that I couldn't live without them. I was a picky eater growing up, so my parents had to bribe me with Dairy Queen ice cream to make me eat my meals. It worked like a charm. If I was really uncooperative, the ante was raised to a blizzard. How could I resist? Oreo blizzard or bust. This technique also worked for doing outside activities like 5-pin bowling or swimming. I was in a bowling league for 3 years and stuck with swimming for close to 7 years, even getting 2 levels behind a certified lifeguard. My parents were really good to me. For example, I got an allowance for doing nothing until I was 9. Then all I had to do was my own laundry, set the table, and load and unload the dishwasher. I was making $5 a week, which at the time felt like I was swimming in money. When I turned 14, I started to clean the house and water the plants. I got $30 a week for my efforts. One summer, when I was 6, my parents took me camping near Osoyoos. We were having a picnic and we overheard the family adjacent to us saying they had just picked up a Nintendo for only $99. That was much cheaper than anything we had seen in Nanaimo. My parents went over to them and asked where they had gotten the Nintendo, and they told us they had gotten it from the Safeway just across the border in the United States. Perfect. We went across the border and bought the Nintendo with my allowance money that I had been saving. I would play Duck Hunt and Mario Brothers after school. This gave me something to do. The first game console made me an avid gamer, and afterward I would get a new game every year for my birthday. At age 10, I developed a huge interest in computers, and my parents bought their first one. I was fascinated by their operating systems and what you could do with them. One of the best aspects of these technologies was that I didn't have to interact with people. I could play and tinker around to my heart's content. I wanted to earn some more money, so when I turned 11, I got a paper route and went out a couple of times a week. I lugged the papers door-to-door using a wagon. My parents helped me when they could by loading and unloading my wagon. I'm not sure if it was because my parents helped or because I was a naturally good paper.